I'm Joan Zamet. I am Director of Development here at the library. And all I'm going to say about that is thank you to everyone who supported us last year. As we always say on evenings like this, your support makes evenings like this and so much more possible. So we're very grateful, and thank you, as always. For all the members here, you know we have a few rules and regulations at this library. No cell phones, so if you have yours on, please turn them off now. You have to wear shoes, no eating, and no loud talking. However, if you come to return a book or pick up a book and you have your dog with you, your dog does not have to wear shoes. We have an array of treats here, depending on the size of your dog, so we hand them out happily. And if your dog barks loudly as he or she can, my colleagues run to the front of the building and are jubilant. I also discovered, you know, we keep records of all your giving and all your memberships, and if we know your dog's name, I just saw yesterday your dog's in the in our records too, and so they're very important to us. So Alexandra, you're in the right place. And Alexandra Horowitz, who I'm going to introduce right now, is a member of the library and a New York Times bestseller. She teaches psychology at Barnard College, and prior to her academic career, she was a lexicographer for Merriam-Webster and served on the staff of The New Yorker. Her family includes Finnegan, a dog of indeterminate parentage and determinate character. And she also, in addition to her husband, has brought a new member of her family with her, Ogden, who, if you look around, is a wonderful addition. So please join me in welcoming Alexandra Horowitz to speak to you tonight.
Thanks, Joan. Thanks to the library for having me come and talk. I spend a lot of time being very quiet in this library, so it's nice to have an opportunity to speak up. There is an oft-told parable, which I, too, will now oft-tell. There are a number of variations on this tale, but all involve two essential components, blind men and an elephant. The story goes something like this. These, let's say, five blind men meet an elephant. You have to suspend disbelief because apparently they've never met an elephant. They don't know what an elephant is. And so they're trying to puzzle over what it is. The first steps forward, touches an ear, and declares an elephant is like a fan. The second steps forward, touches a leg, the first thing he encounters, and says, you're wrong, elephants are like tree trunks. The third, touching the side, says, both of you are wrong, he is like a wall. The fourth, touching the trunk, says, no, he's a snake. The fifth, the tusk, says, it's more like a large spear. So you get the idea. The idea is, of course, that we should be cautious, declaring that the world is just how we think it is. It's a very tidy parable. But actually, I think it's not so tidy. For instance, we're wrong to attribute so little acuity to the blind men. Neuroscientific evidence shows that cells in the visual areas of the blind are swarmed by inputs from other senses, from the ears, from the skin. Eventually, the cortex of a blind person is reorganized to have extra area devoted to the other senses. Those senses become hyperacute. That blind man touching the side of the elephant wouldn't just feel its firmness and its flatness like a wall, but presumably he'd also hear the way the sounds of the room change as he approaches the huge animal's side. He might feel the denseness and tautness of the skin as an ordinary petter of elephants would not. He might hear or feel the low frequency sounds produced when the elephant chews and conducted through the massive bones of his body. From blind men and elephants, it's but a small, gracefully executed side leap to dogs, at least to my latest obsession and the one described in my book about dogs. I want us to reconsider what we think the dog is. He is the elephant in the tale, often touched but little understood. He's also the blind man, a toucher, yes, but more important, a bearer of a perspective, of a worldview, a sensorium, what I'll refer to as an Umwelt that's different than ours, limited in some ways, but also unimaginably richer than ours in others. Well, not wholly unimaginable. I want us to do that imagining. Umwelt is a notion introduced by a German biologist around the turn of last century named Jakob von Uxkull, and he meant by Umwelt a surrounding world or self-world. If we want to talk intelligibly about animals, he suggested, we need to understand their perspectives, and that involved appreciating how they interacted with the environment. Animals dovetailed into the environment, he thought. An elephant's behavior has logic in elephant land, and for our purposes, a dog's behavior has logic in a dog's world. In other words, the world is not simply defined by how we see it, though, as we'll see, the interesting spin here is that we're a part of the dog's world. So to get to the Umwelt of the dog, what it's like to be the dog, we have to have some idea of his sensory abilities, his cognitive abilities, what he evolved to do, and so on. Before we begin that, an aside, we're assuming, of course, that there is something that it is like to be a dog, or any animal, of course. In philosophy, there's a bit of debate about this, about the nature of subjective experience in animals. The debate is more about what that experience is than whether they've got an experience, though. And this debate got its legs about 35 years ago when the philosopher Thomas Nagel asked in a famously titled paper, "What is it like to be a bat?" We used to think that bats, flitting about as they do in the dark, used a sense of touch to see. We simply couldn't imagine that they were sensing in a way that we preeminent human beings could not. Nagel wrote his paper after the discovery by the ethologist Donald Griffin that bats perceive the world by echolocating, emitting a near constant stream of high frequency shouts, and then at once, at the same time, listening for the sound bouncing back in order to make an instantaneous and ever-changing map of the objects, distances, shapes, textures of the world around them. This boggled Nagel's mind. He intoned that the bat's perception, and thus the bat's subjective experience, is so wildly odd, so improbable, that it's impossible to know what it's like to be that bat. I agree with the mind-boggling part, but I disagree that the boggling of my own mind is any indication that the minds of other animals are entirely immune from our examination. For one thing, we're perfectly happy to talk about what it is like to be another human being. Looked at one way, this is similarly improbable. Not once have I been able to physically open someone's head and snuggle inside of it to get an idea of what it's like to be that person. Nonetheless, without knowing the particulars of another person's experience, I know enough about human perception, about human cognition, that I can make an informed imaginative leap, and in point of fact, we do make this leap every day. Similarly, the more information I have about other species, about their nervous system, their sensory systems, their evolution, their development, the better my guess will be about what it's like to be a member of that species. We do have to give up something very near and dear to us in order to do this, and it's our anthropocentrism, our tendency to see every other animal as a version of human, just simpler and furrier. And we're perceptually provincial. Surely we think there's nothing to see in the world but what we see. After all, we open our eyes in the morning and we can't help it. We spontaneously and instantaneously, automatically see the world. It's usually unambiguous. Here's the clock, here's the lamp, my slippers, the floor. No two ways about it. Alas, there are so many more than two ways about it. The range of the electromagnetic spectrum emitted by the sun, the solar spectrum, which we can see, is about 1/1,000,000th of the total range. Around us every day are honeybirds and songbirds, who see high-frequency ultraviolet light. There are snakes, pit vipers, who see in long, slow infrared. The multitude of ways to see continues beyond the eyes. Slender fish, which detect electrical currents, star-nosed moles, African elephants, humpback whales, all hear supersonically low, low-frequency sounds. The most humble pigeon bobbing along outside on 79th Street can detect and use the magnetic fields of the Earth to navigate home. So, to dogs, then, what is the world like to be a dog? I want to suggest five things as a preliminary way into the dog's head. First, the world is smelly. In some ways, this is a misnomer, like saying our world is sea, teeming with things to see. It's not smelly in the way we think of smelliness. For us, odors tend to be either enticing or repugnant, alluring or foul, evocative or evaded. To the dog, smells are simply information. Their world has a topography wrought of odors. The landscape is brightly colored with aromas. As we humans open our eyes and see the world, dogs come out of sleep with both nostrils working. The dog's anatomy reflects this. The protruding muzzles of most dogs house enormous noses, lined with some 300 million receptor cells committed to detecting the world's perfume. They are exponentially more sensitive to the presence of any scent than we are with our merely 3 million cell schnozzes. Dogs also have a second kind of nose called the vomeronasal organ in the hard palate of the roof of their mouths, able to detect hormones in the air, on your breath, in our skin. They do smell fear and sadness and delight. Even the external portion of the nose, that moist black headliner on the snout, is designed with super smelling in mind. It's wet in order to better snag molecules of odor, which are then dissolved into the tissue and pulled toward the vomeronasal organ to be smelled. But that's not all. Beyond this, the dog has evolved a sophisticated method of sniffing. While we clumsily sniff in and out through the same nostril, dogs create tiny wind currents by exhaling out the side slits of their nose. These exhales help hurry the next nose full of smell into the snout. And what do they smell? Well, to begin, us, we stink. Our mouths, armpits, genitals, hands, feet, simply our skin, are all awash in a haze of odorous molecules. Yes, even those of us who wash often and are very, very clean. A cocktail of scent that allows a dog to identify us by odor before by sight. What else? They smell food on the stove, of course, on your hands, but also in the bag, on the counter, in the next room, on the sidewalk, where it used to be on the sidewalk but has been licked up by another dog, in the urine of that sidewalk licker. They smell who has recently passed by. They smell emotions, change, injury, hormones, disease. What might this olfactory acuity be like? Imagine if each detail of our visual world, say a glimpse of a rose, were matched by a corresponding smell. Each petal on a rose may be distinct, having been visited by insects leaving pollen footprints from faraway flowers. What is to us just a single stem holds a record of who held it and when. A burst of chemicals marks where a leaf was torn. The flesh of the petals, plump with moisture compared to that of the leaf, holds a different odor besides. The fold of a leaf has a smell. So does a dewdrop on a thorn. And time is in those details. While we can see one of the petals drying and browning, the dog can smell this process of decay and aging. Imagine smelling every minute visual detail. That might be the experience of a rose to a dog. What is it like? Second point, it's full of knees. One of the most conspicuous features of the dog is one of the most conspicuously overlooked when contemplating their view of the world, their height. Fewer human height. They are human knee height. One might say that they're often underfoot. Their world is full of knees and ankles and feet. Their view is replete with long skirts and trouser legs dancing with every footfall of the wearer, with shoes and socks stockpiling our odors, full of the hormone-laden sweat we emit from our feet when just stressed or concentrating. It should be no surprise that we find gaping holes in socks or shoes left bedside. They bear the investigation of the incisors of our pups, closely examining our smells. That dog nipping at your pant leg is just pursuing that tantalizing, whipping object you keep dangling in front of his face. The dog's eyes have many more than we do of one kind of cell which fires to motion. He can't help but be mesmerized at that trouser leg, and then to pursue this mesmer with the best tool he's got, his mouth. The dog's world is one closer to the ground. This is quotidian, this is ordinary, but this is also profound. This makes its world all the more odoriferous, for smells loiter and fester in the ground while they distribute and disperse in the air. Sound travels differently along the ground, too. Hence, male nightingales sing to faraway female nightingales from the height of a tree, while ground dwellers tend to use the earth to communicate mechanically. The vibration of a fan on the floor of your home might similarly seem to be shouting communication to a dog nearby. Likewise, loud sounds bounce more loudly off the floor into resting dog ears. Third, it is fleeting and fast. For dogs, perspective, scale, and distance are, after a fashion, in olfaction. But olfaction is fleeting. It exists on a different time scale. Smells don't arrive with the same even regularity as light does to our eyes. This means that in their scent vision, they're seeing things at a different rate than we are. Smell tells time. To sniff a smell that has weakened or deteriorated or been covered is to sniff the past. Odors are less strong over time, so strength indicates newness. Weakness of a smell indicates age. The future is smelled on the breeze that brings air from the place that you're headed. By contrast, we visual creatures seem to look mostly in the present. The dog's olfactory window of what is present is larger than our visual one, including not just the scene currently happening, but also a snatch of the just happened and the up ahead. The present has a shadow of the past and a ring of the future to it. In this way, olfaction is also a manipulator of time, for time is change when represented by a succession of odors. Smells have a lifetime. They move and they expire. For a dog, the world is in flux. It waves and shimmers in front of his nose, and he must keep sniffing for the world to be continually apparent to him, as if we had to repeatedly look at and attend to the world for a constant image to remain on our retina and in our minds. This explains so much familiar behavior, your dog's constant sniffing, for one, and also perhaps his seemingly divided attention, which races from sniff to sniff. Objects only continue to exist as long as odor is emitted and he inhales. While we can stand in one place and take in a view of the world, dogs must do much more moving themselves in order to absorb it all. No wonder they seem distracted. Their presence is continually moving away from them. Anyone who has admired a dog catching a toss ball spastically twirling through the air is essentially seeing that dogs also function a shade faster than we do. It's as though they're a little ahead of us. They actually are. All mammals' eyes work in the same way, by photoreceptor cells translating light waves into electrical activity. The cells do this through a change in their pigment. This change takes time, a very small amount of time. But in that time, the cells can't process any more light. So the rate at which they do this is called the flicker fusion rate. It's equivalent, roughly, to the number of snapshots of the world that the eyes take every second. We then reconstruct those snapshots into perceived smooth motion. So do dogs. But they have a higher flicker fusion rate than we do. They see more snapshots every second. They can see, say, that tossed ball a split second before we do. It's as though dogs can pay attention to the slivers of time when we're blinking. This phenomenon also accounts for their sometimes difficulty learning a behavior which we want them to learn. Often we're slow to see when their behavior has begun. They're lunging toward the future a half step ahead of us. 4, it's full of details. Part of normal human development is learning to notice less than we're able to. The world is awash in details of color, form, sound, but to function, we have to ignore some of it. The world still holds these details. Dogs sense the world at a different granularity, attending to parts of the visual world we gloss over, to sounds we've dismissed as irrelevant. There are 2 reasons for this. One is cultural, that even though dogs live with us, they are not one of us. Dogs aren't let in on many of the secret handshakes and passwords of our culture that are our human birthrights. We humans share an understanding of what is out there in the world. Well, we all begin in a kind of sensory chaos, what William James called an aboriginal sensible muchness. At birth, we're suddenly exposed to a more or less undifferentiated mass of sounds and lights, colors and textures, smells. As children, we learn and develop into humans by drawing attention to certain elements and ignoring others. But let's focus on what we ignore so much. The sounds of the street, the radiator's buzz, our own heart beating in our fingertips or in our temple. Dogs don't know to ignore the sounds of human habits that we ignore, tapping our fingers, cracking our ankles, coughing politely, shifting our weight. A shuffle in a seat, nothing to us. But to the dog, it might foretell rising. Scratching an itch, shaking your head. The mundane is electric to a dog, full of smell and imagined purpose. Nor are they polite enough to know that you don't stare at the limping man on the street, that we don't just rush up and sniff each other's groins without asking nicely anyway. The other part of the reason for this difference is biological. With less ability to see a wide range of colors, dogs aren't colorblind, but they can't distinguish reds and oranges and yellows well. They're more sensitive to contrast and brightness of colors. Thus, they might be reluctant to step into a dark room or balk at a shiny puddle, a puddle we pass by without noticing for a second. With all those motion cells in the eyes, dogs reflexively alert to a deflating balloon, a sad discarded plastic bag wafting along the curb. As a dog owner, I've never been more aware of plastic bags. Their noses, attuned to keep getting smells in, don't ever get inured to odor as ours do. They're constantly receiving a cacophony of input that we miss. 5, objects either fit in the mouth or they don't. The dog defines the world by the ways that he can act upon it. Objects are grouped by how they can be manipulated. They might be mouthed, swallowed, nudged, sat upon, rolled in, and so forth. A ball, a pen, a teddy bear, and a shoe are fundamentally the same thing to a dog. All are objects that they'd like to and can get their mouths around. The affordances, the typical use, the possible ways to act on an object that we see in objects are superseded by dog affordances. A dog is less threatened by a gun than interested in seeing if it fits in his mouth. We humans might agree on the elements of the room we're now in, noting that it's full of chairs and people seated on them, books on shelves, lamps on tables, plush rug underfoot, decorative walls, windows covered by curtains. We've named things and ordered that aboriginal muchness, and it's grown so perfectly familiar to us that we entirely lose the ability to think about it any other way. This is almost certainly not what the dog, wily enough to sneak up the stairs into the members' room at the New York Society Library, sees. Rooms have a parallel life in the dog's world, with areas that quietly collect smells, invisible detritus in the crook of the wall and the floor, fertile areas from which objects and odors come, closets, windows, doorways, heating vents. and sitting areas where people or their identifying perfumes might be found. These bookcases might arouse a fair consideration by a human visitor, but its contents are only of interest to my dog if I squirrel away one of his squeaking toys among the books. Outside, dogs don't so much notice buildings at all. They're too big to be acted on, and so lose meaning to a dog. Ah, but the building's corner, as well as lampposts and fire plugs, wears a new identity each encounter with news of other dog passersby. If you've any doubt how much the affordances we see and dogs see differ, consider the dog's discrimination between what to him is clearly a very good stick, worth chewing, hoarding, and protecting with his life, and another identical, perfectly nice-looking stick, which he won't even sniff at. What have we gained by trying to imagine the smelly, knee-filled, fleeting-fast, detailed world full of objects mouthable or not? It allows us to see that there are ways we behave that miss the umwelt boat of the dog completely. It's incredible how fabulously we misjudge what dogs' worlds are like, that we assume that to say heel should instinctively mean stay to the space directly to my right, that sit, let your bottom feel the floor. They jump at us because our mouths are so far away, but smell terrific. And then in scolding them for jumping, we exhale provocatively at them, washing them in odor. What sweet torture. We wonder why they find our shoes interesting. Smelly end fits in the mouth? What better thing could there be? I'm reminded of a classic paper in psychology about what was called the misbehavior of organisms. In it, the authors described trying to train a raccoon to do a simple task for a reward, in this case, putting a coin in a piggy bank. He learned to do it, got a bit of food as payment, but then he quickly unlearned it. He began inserting the coin, then pulling it back quickly. Even worse, he began rubbing the coins he collected together like a masked miser, never letting go of them. What had happened? The authors finally figured it out by imagining the raccoon's point of view. This dropping of the coin is very much like washing behavior of raccoons in the wild. They often dunk their food in water before eating. The animal was unable to resist the reflexive response to see this as a dunkable thing, and then pull the coin back out, holding on to it to consume later. The raccoon's umwelt included things you might wash. Eventually, the psychologist's umwelt included imagining the raccoon's point of view. Only then could he train the raccoon to do the trick for him. To return to the fable with which I began, we are those fabled blind men when considering dogs, seeing but not seeing. We easily spy the dog in front of us, in our homes, by our sides, and assume, because of the clarity of that scene, that we have analogous clarity into their experience. I suggest that the dog may as well be an elephant, or a fan, or a tree trunk, for all that we typically see. Thank you. I'm happy to take any dog or elephant related question. Yeah. Right. I think that's a great question. Doesn't mean because we emit certain hormones when we're happy or angry or fearful, that doesn't mean that the dog would translate it as happiness or anger or fear. In some cases, they'll default to maybe having an aggressive response to somebody who is exuding fear because they're uncertain about that. There's certainly a lot of anecdotes of people who interpret their dogs coming to them when they're upset as a kind of empathetic gesture. And I think that's a perfectly reasonable thing for us to do, but it's hard to imagine how the dog could be empathetic in the way that we'd like him to be. It's certain that he or she notices and detects a difference, but it's less certain what it would mean to that dog. Yeah. There have been some of these studies, right?
And cancer.
Right. So there are two. In fact, I think it's uncertain exactly how they're detecting these cancerous cells or anticipating. There are different theories, but then again, there are different results, too. So we don't know for sure. There are dogs who've been trained to detect in the urine of patients or in the breath of patients those who have cancerous cells in their body or not. Not all dogs can do. You can't go home and assume that your dog is going to sniff it out on you. They have to be trained to do so. And two, with epileptic seizures, there are some people who have epilepsy who successfully use a dog to tell them to get into a safe place. So there might be something we don't know, chemical, electrical, that the dog is sensing. Again, these are trained dogs. And they're also trained observers. So the epileptic patients have to know what to look for in their dog. So there's a real symbiotic relationship going on there. Yeah, and I think that field of research is only going to expand, but we know very, very little about it now. You mean in the case of the disease detection?
Well, that they're alert to something. How do they understand what the process is, that there's an A and B process?
Well, in fact, that the dog might not understand. I mean, all the dog has to do is to raise an alarm. And then the human has to, so that it's, you could almost train a dog by operant conditioning. As long as there's something they can detect, and they know to do some behavior when they detect that sight. It could be the sight of you. It could be the sight of you falling on the floor. It could be an interesting smell. Then they'll just do the behavior. And if you know to look for that behavior, then you have a relationship there without maybe any mutual understanding, per se. But it works.
Well, I was wondering, and I don't know if there's a better word for it, but the telepathy factor.
Right. What happened at 6 a.m.?
He wanted to go out. I mean, and I couldn't get through the sunlight because the sunlight changed. But I would kind of wake up and I would kind of go to sleep. But it wasn't until the digital clock that
I was going to say, if it was an analog clock, they maybe could hear something, some click in the clock. But there is some, there is something in the sun. There is, they are able to notice the time of day. There's a different temperature in the morning. I mean, all things that in some level we could notice too.
But the light changes every day.
As the seasons go on, sure.
But the other example was, it wasn't my dog, it was a friend's dog who I was watching, where this particular dog knew after she'd been away for a week that she had actually walked in the door downstairs. I live on the 11th floor, and she started barking.
Very good smelling cookies. Yeah.
And he knows that he's not there on certain days,
Sure. There's a scientist who, in fact, has done a bunch of studies on and wrote a book about what he called dogs who know when their owners are coming home. People who report that their dogs seem to, somebody at home notices when their companion is miles away but suddenly heading home, even if it's at a different time of day, et cetera, just as you describe with your friend's dog. And I would say that ultimately it's a bit inexplicable. Although attempts could be made to explain. And one of the attempts, and this is not to try to be a killjoy at all, because this certainly might be true, and part of scientists' onus is to try to explain, and we just haven't. But one of the explanations might be that we don't notice the times that dogs seem to act aroused as though somebody's coming home when nobody is coming home. We only remember the confirming instances and don't remember disconfirming instances. So it might not be that she detected. She also got aroused and ran around some other time, but you immediately forgot about it. And that's the problem with any anecdotal evidence as far as science is concerned. They want to be able to reproduce it in the lab, and it's harder to do than, although it appears everywhere in all sorts of dog owners' story books. So the other point to make there is that I would be not at all surprised if there's a sensory ability, although calling it telepathy is maybe not something I would do, that dogs have that we don't know about. I wouldn't be at all surprised. I mean, we barely have investigated the extent of their olfactory capacity, and we know they have great noses. So there might be some other ability to detect some effect of the world that we just don't know about yet. Yeah. I don't think it's been confirmed. I mean, I think the dogs, there's every reason to believe a dog's memory is as acute as ours, and it would be a memory of smells, right? So do you remember every person you met? No, but you might be surprised to recognize a face that you had forgotten entirely about. It feels like you'd forgotten entirely about. I wouldn't be surprised if dogs are quite good at distinguishing someone who they've met once from someone who they haven't, but neither, I think, would they remember everyone they've smelled. Yeah. Yeah.
My dog, who I've watched publicly, every time the elephants came on, she started to shake. She ran over and put her face against the screen. And then when the elephants weren't there, she backed up. But she was obviously hearing the sounds which the elephants were communicating to each other. And I wonder, was she making any sense of it? Was she hearing a sound and a frequency that was good?
No and yes. Yeah, I think probably they do have a wider range of hearing than we do. They not that much wider, but sufficiently so that it's conceivable some of those supersonic sounds, low frequency sounds, hit the dog's ears. Absolutely. Whether it would have been communicative to the dog, it seems unlikely, simply because the things that the elephant is communicating to another elephant probably just don't translate into the dog's world. But absolutely, that, you know, thanks for bringing elephants and dogs together. That was a great question. But absolutely, that they could detect it. And it's little moments like that that make me so pleased to be watching my dog at the odd moment and see that his world is, you know, not the same exactly as mine. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And he said, other animals, including dogs, don't have that.
Mm-hmm.
And he cited things that we primates or great apes can do, like inviting play. And I said, gee, dogs seem to do that.
Right.
So I was wondering what you feel about this issue of how a dog understands the feelings of other dogs.
Yeah, well, I'm so pleased. You don't know how pleased I am you brought up that question, because, in fact, my first research was studying dog play. If you can say that one can study dog play, you know, I really did. And it was all about trying to discover if dogs were perceiving the intentions of other dogs, were sensitive to the fact that they were interacting with other creatures who had minds, this special characteristic which we seem to think is exclusively human or maybe shared by some of our other primate relatives. I think Tomasello might change his tune now. He's actually started studying dogs a little bit too. It looks like I mean, well, the reason we studied primates for so long was because they seemed the likeliest ones to share some of these interesting capacities. But it looks like dogs have some of these capacities too, and it might have emerged through the long process of domestication, some tens of thousands of years, where we kept selecting for, intentionally or unintentionally, dogs who responded to us in the way we'd expect a human respond to us. The result seems to be dogs who are, for all intents and purposes, intentional creatures to some degree, the way primates are. Ones who, in my research, I found that they not only do play signals to elicit play with other dogs, but they're attentive to how inattentive other dogs are. So they know the difference between trying to play with a dog who's just sitting there doing nothing, idly hanging out, and another dog who's interacting already in play. They'll do a greater attention getter, like a bite on the rump to the dog in play, than to the one who's just sitting there. If you go up and just bite a dog on the rump, that's not an invitation to play, that's an attack. And they know this difference, and it seems to be because they're thinking about other dogs in this preliminary mental way that humans and other primates only seem to. And now dogs are passing all these tests that chimps don't pass that have to do with intention, pointing tests, and they're the great next great experimental subject for cognitive psychology. Yeah?
I don't know when Finnegan entered your life, but is there a before and after with him in terms of what you sort of broke before you did your research and how you came to now, and how is he as a pet to you in terms of the rest of us?
Poor Finnegan, my dog now gets a lot of assessment and evaluation by me. We've lived with Finnegan for about 2.5 years, and when I started doing research in dogs and when I started writing this book, I had another dog, Pumpernickel, and I'd say that my opinion and sort of approach to her really changed a lot, and now Finnegan is kind of reaping the spoils or scrutiny of that. It was sort of because of my former dog that I think I was a pretty ordinary dog owner with a huge curiosity about her, but kind of just letting the question marks sort of hang there in the air. And then I became much more interested once I saw this different mental life of dogs in trying to provide her with a lot more interesting things in her environment. In fact, I think it's very hard to leave a dog alone now for me for any length of time, which is kind of torture because, of course, you know, this is one of the conveniences of owning a dog is that you can leave them, unlike the baby, right? I can't leave him. He comes everywhere, or I stay where he is. But now I also see, you know, all this time that we're leaving our dogs is, it's really boring. You know, they're sophisticated mental creatures, and I feel like I kind of owe it to my dog to try to provide things for him to do and games to do and lots of social interaction and so forth. So he gets a lot of scrutiny, a lot of attempts to sort of stimulate him in the ways that I know his mind can work. Yeah. As emotional intelligence? You mean this perception of... Yeah, well, I think it's... One thing is that they're looking at us to begin with. So that's actually pretty profound. You know, no other animals do this, look at us without a predatory gaze. And even a predatory gaze wouldn't be that kind of stare into the eyes that a dog will have with us. And then once they do that, like a lot of the work of creating the relationship happens after that in our imaginations. You know, if you share eye contact with someone else, there is an intimacy in that. It's really just behaviorally two people directed toward each other eventually, you know, but as a matter of fact, when our eyes lock, we think a lot more is going on. And I think the same thing happens with the dog, and maybe a little bit for the dog too. So the fact that they are have this tendency to look at us, I think that that simple fact allows us to create a lot of the relationship on top of it. Yeah. The dog, yes.
Now, when you get to a species dog,
yeah.
You have very definitely differences.
Yeah, a breed in among, yeah.
Right. Now, how do you account for that? Right.
Yeah, well,
now,
I, yeah.
Breed in the dog. Some dogs instinctively do things. You don't have to train them. If you have a deer dog like a Sheltie,
yeah.
Will get you to the deer.
Yeah. Absolutely. Breeding is a huge part. I mean, breeding is really just artificial selection at work, right? So instead of it being natural selection, which has evolved this nose, which has extraordinary acuity, it's our saying, gee, I really liked those that dog which barked in the vicinity of the deer because I was able to take advantage of it to arrow that deer down, and breeding that dog with another one who has the same sensitivity. And then that generation gets bred, and such... What that dog actually knows is probably not about deer and not about informing humans that there's a deer nearby, but sort of has a special sensitivity to a type of motion, say, or a certain smell. And it causes the dog to be aroused, and then the dog barks. But through interbreeding over time, you get this real specific behavior in certain breeds that to us has a different purpose, but it's a nice example of how we're seeing what the dog is doing a little bit differently than what the dog is actually doing. Yeah.
What is it like to be a scientist?
I don't know. It's smelly. Yeah.
I know that I don't know very much about it, but I've heard that in such fields as philosophy and science, people have looked at how it is that the kind of animal we are gets us, knowing the things the way we know them.
Yeah.
And what is it about? What kind of rules do we make because of the kind of beings we are? What I'm wondering, what I hadn't considered before, is whether scientists or philosophers of sciences, philosophers of science, are now actually learning from the kind of work you and people like you do, imagining how dogs know things, like bringing that back. Have we learned, got a different perspective by analogy to the way other animals, and what we learn about how other animals' knowledge is conditioned by the kind of animal they are?
Yeah, I wish that this stretched scientists' umwelt, but I don't think that it really does. But it does sometimes, I think what it does is create a kind of new branch or bud of science, some of which has to do with trying to reproduce what animals' worlds are like in an artificial form, and then a way, that's a different way of seeing the world. And some of which is just interested in animals qua animals, as opposed to compared with humans. And that's also an interesting little outgrowth of science. But yeah, to be a scientist is to have a narrow worldview. In fact, it kind of demands a narrow worldview. You have to delimit your perception in some way. So never trust scientists. Yeah. Right. Well, I don't. But so a lot of the things I write about in my book are from other researchers. In fact, the majority of it is other research, especially the sensory abilities, because I don't have biological or chemical experience, so I'm taking their word for it. And the dogs tell me very little directly. The test for colorblindness, you would probably train, and I know that some people have trained, just as you would for detection of a concentration of a scent, train a dog to make a judgment of a discrimination judgment. So you show them two cards of the same color, and they've learned to note if it's the same or different. And they press one button if it's the same, and another button if it's different, and they get rewarded on stimuli which they recognize, maybe toys first, if they push the correct button. And then you could give them these color cards, make the cards more or less similar, and see where they start to notice the same or difference. And basically you're asking, if you're motivated, you know, will you use your senses to the best of your abilities to solve this problem? It's assuming that you have a motivated dog. And it's tests like that that allow us to know this about color, their color perception. Yeah?
I was going to ask, do dogs see in the dark?
Yeah, do they see in the dark? Yes. They see even better in the dark. Then. Is it necessary to leave the lights on? I think not. It's sort of a cultural thing, actually, right? That you leave the lights on if there's something sentient in the room. But I don't think they don't need the lights on. They have more of these rod photoreceptors than we do. So they're much, and they also have this lens in something called the tapetum lucidum in their eye, which allows light to hit the cells of their eyes twice, because it bounces the light back, and so it's sort of seen twice. This is why when you take a camera or a photo of a dog with a flash, it sometimes you get red in the eyes, because the light is bouncing back off of that extra lens in the eye. So they can see quite well at night. And leaving the TV on, incidentally, I think is probably pretty interesting for the noise and the ruckus and just some interesting stimulation, but not because they're keen on the particular program. Sorry. Yeah, okay.
We have time for one more question.
The cue.
That would be the cue. And if he was going and the light was off and he wanted to go to sleep, he would come out and bark.
To put the light on.
To put the light on. And then I would.
This shows how dogs live in a different world. A sensible creature. Thanks.
Just wanted to say thanks to Alexandra for a fascinating talk tonight, and for all of you dog owners, go home and be kind to your dogs. And we have books for sale, and Alexandra is available to sign them if you'd like to stay around. Thanks for coming.